No census has ever been taken of Lhasa's population, but rough estimates place it at 25,000. However, if one includes the monks who live in the nearby hills at Drepung, Sera and Ganden, three large monasteries often called the Three Pillars of State, and the monks in many smaller monasteries, the population probably comes closer to 50,000. And that figure is doubled during holidays when pilgrims swarm into the capital. In many respects, Lhasa reminded me of the Turkish town of Kars in the Lower Caucasus, also in mountainous country and with narrow, muddy streets. Even the Kars Bazaar resembles the one at Lhasa, with merchandise laid out on tables along the streets, shaded by canvas awnings and umbrellas. The Lhasa Bazaar attracts all strangers in the city, Tibetan country folk, Ladakhi, Sikkimese and Mongolian pilgrims, as well as rare Western visitors, like us. It was surprising what could be purchased in the holy city under the awnings and umbrellas of the noisy merchants. Sunglasses, mirrors, cigarettes, soap, aluminium pots, flashlights and toilet articles are jumbled together on the stalls with oriental silks, tea and jewelry. Yes, a few small articles from the West are available at a stiff price, since everything must be brought in by caravan. These few products of the machine age, however, have had little effect on the culture of the community. For instance, nothing is known of modern plumbing in Lhasa. Those in the Dalai Lama's capital who bother to bathe, and nobles and officials do use pitchers and basins. Refuse piles up in all corners of the city. Once a year these awful heaps are transferred to the fields to stimulate crops. The odors of Lhasa are not entirely pleasant. The nobles usually hold scented handkerchiefs to their noses as they ride along. To add to this unpleasantness, dead animals are tossed on the refuse piles, to be fought over and devoured by the city's scavengers, thousands of mangy dogs and ravens. If it were not for the rigorous mountain climate, the strong sunshine and the almost complete absence of flies or other insects, Lhasa would have a major health problem. But the few unpleasant aspects of Tibet's capital are more than offset by its fascinating people in their attractive costumes, the hospitality, the gaiety and strangeness of it all, and the pageantry, which has come down in Tibet like a tapestry brought vividly to life from the Middle Ages. Plans are now afoot for the complete electrification of the city. When the equipment arrives from England and Lhasa is lighted by modern methods, I imagine that a regular procession of electrical appliances will make its slow way over snowbound passes and across windswept plains. That is, unless what happened once before repeats itself. Some years ago Lhasa ordered electrical equipment, but the coolies lugging the heavy machinery over the mountains from India found that it was much quicker and easier to let gravity do part of their work, so they rolled as much of the load as they could down the boulder-strewn passes. Naturally, most of the apparatus was ruined beyond repair. People of means travel about the city on horses or mules. The others walk. For Lhasa, like every other place in Tibet, has no wheeled vehicles. Even for heavy hauling, there are no carts. We saw a great deal of construction going on, but the stone and earth for this work are carried on the backs of men or donkeys. Why, we asked Tibetan officials, isn't the wheel employed in their country as a means of transportation? The answer was typically Tibetan. We were told that even if the simple ox cart was used, Tibet's narrow trails would have to be expanded into roads, and roads disfigure the country and anger the spirits. We were saving the sparkling golden-roofed Potala for a special leisurely visit. Next to the Potala, the chief point of interest in Lhasa is the Jokhang, or cathedral, in the heart of the city. This great temple is perhaps the holiest place in a country studded with shrines. Under a roof lavishly ornamented with gold rests a huge, jewel-encrusted image of Buddha, brought from China in the 7th century by one of the wives of King Songtsen Gampo. As I told in another chapter, the great king presided over the birth of Tibetan civilization as we know it today, and he was converted to Buddhism by his two wives, a Chinese princess and a princess from Nepal. The two queens used his influence to spread Buddhism throughout Tibet. monasteries were erected and the priesthood established to lay the foundations for the Buddhist religious fervor so strong in Tibet today. In the Jokang, Songtsen Gampo's image of Buddha and other smaller figures are surrounded by scores of flickering yak butter lamps. On the afternoon of our visit, groups of monks, chanting softly, were conducting religious services in the cathedral, which is the first stop for Buddhist pilgrims visiting the capital. The great court within the Jokang is lined on either side with hundreds of small cylindrical prayer wheels set on greased spindles. When the monks stroll by, they spin each barrel-like wheel until the entire row is in motion. The rumbling of these wheels, transmitting thousands of prayers to Buddha simultaneously, sounds like the roar of a diving roller coaster. Rats and mice run unmolested through the temple, nibbling at the barley offerings of pilgrims. The monks' belief in reincarnation keeps them from harming these creatures. On the outskirts of Lhasa live most of Tibet's nobility, an exclusive group which seldom admits those of lower status to its ranks. They live in three or four tree homes, constructed of mud-smented stone. On each corner of the flat roofs are festoons of prayer flags. The Tibetans love flowers, and most homes are fronted by flower gardens. This comparative luxury is in direct contrast to the way the commoners live in small houses of stone, or in yokhair tents. However, the residents of Lhasa, regardless of their status, are merry and hospitable, especially during the joyous summer festival period. Our excursions about the town invariably aroused peals of laughter from the populace. With our fair complexions, narrow, sunburned noses, and our sweaters, ski pants and boots, we must have seemed very odd to the Tibetans. Our manner of riding, posting in the saddle, instead of jouncing as they do, also seemed to tickle the Tibetan funny bone. But we had no objection to their merriment at our expense. It was far better to be so welcomed to Lhasa than to be confronted by the hostility that had greeted some travelers in the past. 12. The 14th Dalai Lama. Arrangements were made for our visit to the Dalai Sidi Lama a couple of days after the summer festival. We were eager with anticipation at the prospect of meeting His Holiness. No ruler, today, we reflected, commands the homage and devotion, both in spiritual and temporal matters, accorded to the leader of Tibet's kingdom in the clouds. To his followers, the pontiff in the Potlu is a divine incarnation of Chenrezi, the mulch-armed, multi-headed patron god of the Tibetans. In view of our coming visit to the God King, we were naturally interested in tracing back the sacred Tibetan dynasty to its beginnings, reviewing in our minds all we had previously read and what we had heard in the past few weeks from Tibetans themselves about the Dalai Lamas. They have a fascinating history. In the 14th century, Lotus Thunderbolt, son of a herdsman in eastern Tibet, manifested phenomenal spiritual qualities from his childhood. He became a monk, an ardent disciple of the reformer Tsongkhapa, who founded the Yellow Hat sect. Known as the perfecter of the priesthood, Lotus Thunderbolt established the great Yellow Hat monasteries of Drepung and Tashi Lunpo. Some years after his death, his spirit was believed to have passed into another monk, who then became head of Drepung. By this time the idea was firmly rooted that a few saintly persons, through the holiness of their lives, were entitled to pass into Buddhahood, but that sometimes they renounced this privilege to return to earth and help others attain spiritual elevation. However, the head of the Yellow Hats still concentrated on spiritual authority, making little effort to exercise secular control. It was the third in order of succession, Sonam Gyatso, who received the title Dalai Lama Vajradhara, their all-embracing Lama, the holder of the thunderbolt from the powerful Mongol chief Altan Khan in the middle of the 16th century. Sonam Gyatso, regarded as the third Dalai Lama, expanded Buddhism not only in Tibet, but also spread the faith among the Mongols, who were especially attracted to the Tibetan form of Buddhism. The fifth and the late 13th Dalai Lama are always spoken of by Tibetans as the Great Fifth and the Great 13th. The fifth was Lobsang Gyatso, born the son of a poor villager not far from Lhasa. He had continuous struggles with the older Red Hat sect, which refused to recognize his authority. In 1641, with the help of the Ilot Mongols, the Dalai Lama subdued the warlike Red Hats and elevated the Yellow Hats, his own sect, to be the rulers of Tibet. After this bloody battle, a strange occupation for monks who ordinarily will not kill even an insect, the fifth Dalai Lama started to build the magnificent Potala and made Lhasa the hermit nation's capital. It was during the first years of the fifth Dalai Lama's rule that Capuchin friars were permitted to reside and preach in Lhasa. Jesuit fathers came during the latter part of his reign. I shall tell about these missionaries later. Although the fifth Dalai Lama delegated much of his secular power to his chief minister, he was responsible for consolidating the country and centralizing both government and religious authority in Lhasa. The 13th Dalai Lama died, or as Tibetans put it, departed to the heavenly field in 1933, at the age of 57. He went into exile twice during his eventful reign, once to Mongolia during the Young Usmund expedition in 1904, and again to India in 1910 when the Chinese invaded Tibet. Despite these enforced absences, he managed to retain the devotion of his people and ruled wisely until his death. During his 2 years exile in India, the Chinese issued a proclamation deposing him, but the Tibetans spattered the publicly posted announcements with mud and continued to turn to their living god in exile as the supreme authority. For an intimate and very human picture of the great 13th, the West is indebted to Sir Charles Bell, who knew him better than did any Westerner or, in fact, any Chinese or Asiatic except the Tibetan officials close to his person, and a few Mongols. Bell was in charge of the Chumbi Valley the year after the Young Usmund expedition, and from 1908 to 1918 he was political officer supervising British-Indian relations with Tibet and Bhutan. The 2 years the Dalai Lama lived as an exile in Darjeeling, he struck up a warm friendship with Bell, whom he consulted on many of the problems troubling him. And they spoke man to man in private, for Bell was fluent in Tibetan. More than that, he had a genuine grasp and understanding of the Tibetan point of view, and great affection for the Tibetans. In 1920, at the request of the Dalai Lama, he was sent in charge of a British diplomatic mission to Lhasa, where he remained almost a year, longer than any Westerner had ever remained in the Forbidden City except for a few 18th-century missionaries, but unlike them, he came as the invited guest and personal friend of the Tibetan pontiff. Many Tibetans believe that Bell in his previous life had been a high Tibetan Lama who prayed before he died that he might be born in a powerful country in order to help Tibet. When the time came for him to leave, the Dalai Lama could hardly bear to part with his old friend and said sadly, "We have known each other for a long time, and I have complete confidence in you, for we two are men of like mind. I pray continually that you may return to Tibet." They never saw each other again, although they corresponded and remained friends until the Dalai Lama's death. Sir Charles Bell, then in retirement in England, made one more visit to Tibet in 1934. He died at the age of 75 in 1945, leaving as his legacy to Tibet and the West several revealing books on the people, customs, history and religion of the country he had come to love in more than 20 years of close contact, a wealth of information on which all travelers to Tibet, including myself, have drawn freely and gratefully. Sir Charles Bell regarded the last Dalai Lama as a selfless ruler who had died from overstrain in the service of Tibet and praised the improvements the ruler made in administration and his determined and largely successful efforts to shake off Chinese domination during his reign. Before the great 13th, no Dalai Lama had exercised complete spiritual and temporal power through his whole adult life. Many of them had died mysteriously before they were 18, with the regent in control. But in 1933 the throne, so long occupied by the 13th Dalai Lama, was temporarily empty, and all Tibet felt the void. Everyone prayed for his return in the body of a child. When a new pontiff is to be selected, Tibet is thrown into an excitement and confusion greater than the fever which sweeps America during a presidential election year. Before an old ruler departs to the heavenly field, he sometimes tells those around him where he will be reincarnated. 3 or 4 years after the Dalai Lama has been placed in his tomb on the summit of the Potala, the abbots of the Drepung, Sera and Ganden monasteries, the oracles at Lhasa and at the same monastery 50 miles southeast of Lhasa, as well as other high officials, meet to decide in which part of the country his reincarnation is likely to be found. There is bound to be one, because the Dalai Lama has pledged himself to dwell among mortal men to serve them, although he has won the right to rest in the spiritual world. The state oracle is consulted. In a vision, the general area of reincarnation is revealed to him. The oracle's vision may have included a peasant's stone hut on the shore of a lake, a hut with a stream flowing by, on with a single snow peak in the background. Armed with such a description, the Panchen Lama, if he has arrived at his majority, and other officials traditionally delegated to make the investigation scour the country. Eventually they find the spot and the hut or little stone house which best fits the oracle's vision. If the peasant child living there bears some of the signs that distinguish an incarnate Chenrezig, such as marks like those of a tiger's skin on his legs, large ears, two pieces of flesh near the shoulder blades symbolizing the other two hands of the Buddha of Mercy, there is little doubt that he is the reincarnated Dalai Lama. But if there should be uncertainty as to which of several candidates is the right holiness, the true reincarnation will unerringly select several objects used by the Dalai Lama in his last life. That is the belief of all devout Tibetans. Usually 3 or 4 boys who fit the preliminary requirements turn up, and rival regions are very active on behalf of their local candidates. The high lamas pick out the one whom they believe to reveal the most evident proof of being a reincarnation of Chenrezig, but there have been times when considerable political pressure or powerful influence was brought to bear on the choice made. The boy selected is brought to Lhasa with his parents, brothers and sisters, who are installed in regal splendor. The father of a Dalai Lama is, given the rank of Kung, the highest title that can be held by a commoner in Tibet. The little Dalai Lama does not live with his family. He is taken to the Potala to be tutored and given intense religious training for his future role as God King. Until he becomes 18 years of age, a regent and the high priests rule for him. The present Dalai Lama is now 16 years old. The search for the 14th incarnation, as told to us in Lhasa, before we met him, is a revelation of the way Tibet clings to its old rituals and beliefs. Several signs indicated that the rebirth would take place in the northeast. It is said that when the 13th Dalai Lama's body was embalmed, the face was turned to the south. But when the coffin was opened to put in fresh salt, the precious protector had his face turned northeast. Then, too, many rainbows and clouds were seen going northeast. The searching party went to eastern Tibet, to one of the many districts annexed by the Chinese during their 1910 invasion. There they met the Panchen Lama, still in exile, who gave them the names of 3 possible candidates. The first, they found, was dead. The second ran off crying when shown the articles belonging to the late Dalai Lama. The third was found in October, 1937, near Sining, in the province of Kokonor, another Tibetan region confiscated by the Chinese. But his parents were pure Tibetan, and his father a comparatively well-to-do farmer. All the signs seemed right. The leader of the searching party sent a lama disguised as a servant into the farm kitchen. The two-year-old boy was playing on the floor and, it is reported, he immediately said, "Lama, Lama," and even named the monastery from which the Lama came. A few days later he is said to have selected several articles belonging to the great 13th. The Lamas announced that they found several marks on his body, indicating that he was a reincarnation of Chenrezig, Buddha of Mercy. Everything seemed settled, except to take the boy to Lhasa for a final test. But the Chinese governor of the province refused to let the child go without an exorbitant blackmail payment. It was more than a year before this outrageous demand was settled. Tibet paid the blackmail and in September, 1939, the Tibetan search party returned to Lhasa with the child, who was immediately declared the true incarnation. At the Tibetan New Year in February, 1940, the 14th Dalai Lama was enthroned. Everyone at the ceremony in the Potala, including the British representative, Sir Basil Gould, commented on the dignity of the five-year-old living god. He had to be lifted on his throne for the long ritual during which the high lamas prostrated themselves before him, and he in turn blessed each one personally, with an ease, it is said, that seemed to come natural to him. Indeed, as the 14th reincarnation of Chenrezig, he must have had plenty of practice. The young Dalai Lama is, of course, being educated according to tradition. He must always lead a life of celibacy. His brothers came to play with him when he was a child, but never his sisters. He must never drink alcoholic beverages, although he may eat meat. Learned lamas have tutored him from an early age and given him a thorough grounding in Buddhist theology, meditation and the Tibetan sacred books. He lives the comparatively simple, secluded life, as becomes a young living god still under the guardianship of a regent, but he has many attendants to take care of all his needs. The name he received on his initiation into the priesthood is, by the way, quite a tongue twister: Getsun Wen Lobsang Tenjin Jiapso Sisun Wang Yer Chung Pamapid Hepal Sangpo. Meaning in plain English, the Holy One, there, gentle glory, powerful in speech, pure in mind, of divine wisdom, holding the faith, ocean-wide. All we heard about the Dalai Lama only whetted our desire for the coming audience. On the day of our visit, two nobles from the court, official interpreter Imsi Kayapup and our official host, Dor Cheng Wibu, arrived to escort us to Norbulinga, the summer palace. They were dressed in bright red and gold gowns, wore 6-inch turquoise pendants in their ears, more turquoise in their top knots, and all this gay finery was crowned with dazzling yellow hats. After a last minute inspection and repacking of presents and a selection of our finest white silk scarves, our court cavalcade galloped off. All of us were mounted on horses and mules richly ornamented for this exciting occasion. First, to clear the way, went the outriders, wearing their floppy, wide-brimmed brilliant red hats. They were followed by our two nobles, to whom all the common people bowed as we passed. The Thomases, father and son, were next in line. We were the strange individuals at whom everyone in the Lhasa street gaped. Behind us came our three servants, together with the Chogpan who had guided us from Yatung to the capital. They carried our presents for the Dalai Lama. For His Holiness our principal gift was a genuine tiger skull teeth, snarl and all, set in silver and gold by a Siamese silversmith in Bangkok. We brought another skull, similar to the first but smaller, for the regent. Also for His Majesty we had a folding travel alarm clock, a plastic raincoat from America, and a bag of coins in a white scarf, this last a symbolic gift expected of all visitors. It would be an unpardonable breach of etiquette not to bring gifts. Before we left Tibet, the Dalai Lama and the regent returned the courtesy with presents for us: Tibetan rugs, rolls of woolen cloth and a beautiful Tibetan religious painting. At the palace, we waited for the Dalai Lama in the same courtyard where the religious luncheon had been served on the last day of the festival. Nearby, outside the throne room, a group of perhaps 100 monks sat silently sipping tea. They stared at us curiously. On the roof two monks blew eerie notes from 3-foot brass and bone trumpets. It was not music, at least not the kind I was familiar with. They held one note for an interval of several minutes before switching to another. Soon these small horns were joined or then replaced by 2 12-foot horns, which produced a low, thundering tone like the bass horn in a band. The latter instruments were so heavy that, by way of support, they were placed across a golden stand on the edge of the roof. This steady note trumpeting must have had some definite religious significance. Suddenly, a monk climbed a ladder across the courtyard and struck a golden gong several times with his mallet. This was the signal for the start of the morning reception. A line of a dozen or so monks quickly formed at the entrance of the low-slinged, Buddha-curated throne room. We were told to fall in behind them, followed by our servants with the gifts. After us came 50 or more Tibetans anxious to receive the blessing of the living Buddha. Inside, Through a haze of incense smoke, we could see the youthful Dalai Lama sitting bareheaded on his high, cushioned throne. Bright-eyed and smiling, he was dressed in a red Lama robe. To our surprise, he kept smiling throughout the ceremony, smiling at us. In a moment we were standing at his feet. My father, who had been instructed to lead our procession, held a white silk scarf in his outstretched hands. In less time than it takes to tell about it, the Lord Chamberlain placed on the scarf symbolic objects which the Dalai Lama took, one after another. The first, shaped like three mountains, represented the world. The others were placed on the scarf and then whisked off by the Dalai Lama with such speed that we had difficulty in making out what they were. One was an image representing the body, another, a book, for speech, a third, a cotton, symbolizing the mind. Then the scarf itself was taken by one of the Dalai Lama's monk servants. Dad stepped a bit closer, and bowed forward. As he did so, the Dalai Lama extended his right hand and touched my father's head with his fingers, thus bestowing his blessing. Then he presented Dad with a small red scarf. The same ritual was repeated with the regent, who sat on a lower throne at the Dalai Lama's right. Now it was my turn. I went through the same procedure except that I did not have to make the symbolic presentations. After the regent's blessing we were directed to the Dalai Lama's left and part way back in the audience chamber, to seats on cushions. My view of the throne was blocked by one of the tapestried pillars, but by leaning back a little I could see His Holiness. He smiled and kept glancing down at us, obviously as curious as any of his subjects about two strangers from far away America. From our cushions on the floor, we looked about the chamber. Above the throne hung a set of thangkas, scroll banners of Tibetan religious themes, each containing Buddha figures and conceived in the old Chinese style that emphasizes serenity and delicacy more than personality or individuality of expression. Seated on the floor on either side of the throne were six or more high lamas. Many other monk retainers stood in the background, and several giant monks walked back and forth, the same bodyguards who officiated at the summer festival. The whole time we were in the audience room, the prolonged rumble of the trumpets on the roof came to our ears like faint echoes from a Tibetan spirit world. We watched the devotees shuffle by the throne, none daring to look up. The Dalai Lama flicked their heads with a tassel suspended from the end of a short rod. He blesses with his hand only monks and distinguished visitors. All common folk and all women, including wives of ministers, get the tassel. The thunderbolt so. The incarnate abbess who presides over the monastery at Nygartz, is the exception. As soon as the shuffling line of Tibetans had been hustled from the room, monks brought us bowls of rice. We flicked a few grains over our right shoulders, then took one taste. That was all, just a ceremonial gesture. The monks brought us a half dozen bricks of Tibetan barley bread, which our servants wrapped up and carried home. We tried it later for lunch, but it was too rich and too strong with rancid yak butter for our taste. We also had cups of Tibetan tea, which we sipped once ceremonially. Before the Dalai Lama drank any tea, however, Dor, our companion, was called forward to perform an ancient ritual. On his knees before the throne, he pulled a small wooden bowl out from under his robe. Into this was poured a little of the tea the Dalai Lama was to drink. Dor downed it in one gulp. By so doing he proved that there was no poison in the priest-king's tea, a custom that goes back to the days when some of the Tibetan monarchs were poisoned by jealous regents or lamas. After our audience with the Dalai Lama we had an interview with the regent, the man who will continue to wield the power in Tibet for another 2 years, when the Dalai Lama at 18 becomes of ruling age. No Tibetan is certain what will happen then, but if the young Dalai Lama continues to develop as he has in recent years, they are confident that he will assume absolute power, as did his great predecessor, the 13th. The regent received us in a reception hall not far from the throne room. His Highness, named Okra, is 73 years old but still in vigorous health and mentally alert. The story of his rise to power is unusual and typically oriental. At the death of the 13th Dalai Lama, the Retting Rinpoche, Torquera's predecessor, was installed as regent. He was 20 then, neither attractive in personality nor very able.